Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 251st episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of Waterfront Lensers, and I'm here with my co-host, Sean Wisniewski of The Corner Workshop. Tonight, we're visiting with Leslie Webb of Leslie Webb Design fame. She's a professional furniture maker here in Texas and a very cool person. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, not a problem. Not a problem. Well, before we get into talking to you in depth about what you're up to and what you've been doing, let's see if there's anything around the interwebs that's piqued our interest since we last talked. So I got a couple of things. First off is shop security. So
my neighborhood, I'm interested. What do you got?
Yeah, well, my neighborhood is really, really safe. It's about 1,000 houses. We have our own overpaid, overstaffed police force and all this kind of stuff. But we are a waterfront community. And occasionally, boats will come up our canals and they'll steal stuff that's in people's boathouses or sitting outside their yard.
Wow. I mean,
they'll come in like 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And the same thing on our streets. They'll come in and see if they can find any unlocked cars. And we had a rash of that a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I thought, you know, the main thing I have downstairs is all my tools. And I went, you know, it would be relatively easy to break in down there if someone knew what they were doing. And, you know, and I occasionally forget to lock a door down there or something. So I said, well, let me get one of these Ring home security systems. That's the one I decided on. So I got that all set up. And, yeah, it gives me a little peace of mind at night. Now, people can still break into my house, but breaking into my shop, they're going to be stopped dead. No, I got the house covered too, but you know, there's like three ways into my house and two of them go straight through my shop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what made you go with Ring?
Well, I looked at, I forgot the name of the other system that's really hot out there, but, with the Ring, it seemed to be the price for the systems were about the same, I think, as like $250, $270, something like that. But the Ring, you could get the professional monitoring service for $10 a month. And the other one was like almost, like $25 a month.
Oh, okay.
So I went with that. Plus, Ring, I think both systems hook into a lot of stuff, but, you know, they have a lot of third-party systems they hook into. In fact, I bought, outside of the system, I bought a First Alert smoke detector, and that hooks into the system. So, you know, if I'm gone, that goes off. They'll call the fire department and get all that stuff done. So, you know, I just thought it was interesting, but, you know, because, you know, that's the biggest thing I have in my house. If someone were to break in and just if they knew anything about tools, I mean, I got my Festool sitting in sustainers. They could just do. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, planes and things of that nature. But, you know, most of these people, you know, are just looking to make some quick bucks. So they probably wouldn't even know, but they could definitely cart that stuff off easy enough. And, you know, I can just see me. Ah. They go into a pawn shop and see a Festool thing there and go, I bet that's mine.
Yeah, that would be awful. I only ask that only because I've looked at that just for my home a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, but I started out with an interior camera. So, and then I went to a different style. So I, without any outside security services, I've got cameras monitoring my house.
Yeah,
viewable on my phone and all the other stuff. So there's a lot of options out there, and I guess that's maybe important to put out there depending on your situation,
right?
And all that.
Yeah, and that's one thing I didn't mention about the Ring is like that $10 a month. If you do have a camera system, that includes that and recording that and storing it in the cloud.
Yeah. So there,
I don't have a camera yet, but I might get one of those. Right. I guess they're famous for the little Ring doorbell things. I didn't get one of those, but I might add that to the system here shortly.
Right. So I went, my first camera was an Arlo, which is another brand out there. Mm-hmm. Night vision, motion, sound active, two-way audio, all that stuff. That was fairly expensive, $100-some for mm-hmm. that. But I had it monitoring a specific section of my house where my cats eat, and we were finding other, you know, patrolling issues for my animals that I wanted to keep an eye on, and it worked well for that. Then, most recently, and I just ordered another one, I heard of cameras they go by the name Wyze, mm-hmm. W-Y-Z-E. They're these itty-bitty inch-and-a-half cubes that run $25 that record HD video fee-free for a week at a time and just automatically offsets. You can download it anytime once you've got. Again, motion and sound active, night vision, all that stuff. And I actually heard about that from a coworker who has six of them all around his house. He's got greyhounds. He's got, you know, stuff. And he just pulled up and he gets this array on his phone of all cameras monitoring all corners of his house. And he paid less than $150 for it.
Wow.
I went, okay. I mean, for $25, I could eat lunch for more than $25.
Yeah.
You know, that mm-hmm. is worth trying. And I'm more than happy with the ones I've got of those.
Really?
So I got one watching my front door, one watching the back door.
Yeah.
And so I know, and I got this right at the end of school year, so I'll use it a little more next year, but I know when my kids get home from school. I know when my dog's getting in the garbage, you know, crap like that. But it's one of those things that I'm getting a notification on my phone and on my watch when those things are picking up action.
So you can put you can put these outdoors? They're waterproof or water resistant?
No, these are not outdoors for that cheap. There are other ones out there that can do that.
Right.
But I guess it just shop your options. There's a lot out there. Mm-hmm. A managed security system is one thing. Personal cameras is another thing. Like you mentioned, peace of mind. I definitely got some peace of mind.
Yeah.
Knowing what I've got going on at the perimeters of the entryways of my house, I can see them at a whim notice, and I get notified when there's action there. Mm-hmm. That's beneficial to me. Your mileage may vary, so check it out. But I think it's a really important thing. I mean, if you, mm-hmm. Everybody has some level of security concern, and each one is individual. You know, suburban, urban. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever, outside, separate shop. I mean, if I had a remote shop, hell yes, I'd have security.
Oh, right?
You and I, you know, even the guys that walk across their lawn to a separate building, you'd want to know what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, no, that's good. Yeah. I hope so. Is that a magnetic door catch kind of security?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Magnetic door catch. It's wireless. It's got a little battery in it. And I think it works either. It works on Z-Wave, and then the actual unit itself works via Wi-Fi. If Wi-Fi goes down, it's got a cell connection to it.
So that's pretty good.
Yeah,
so it's got a lot going on for it. And Ring's been doing good mm-hmm. stuff, so no doubt that's some good stuff.
All right, next up, I wanted to talk about Bridge City Tools. If you might remember, they got. I don't know, I guess sold to a Japanese firm that was manufacturing their high-end tools, and they recently just came out with two new planes that are designed by John Konamaki, if I'm pronouncing his name right. And I think he's still involved with the company. He just doesn't do the day-to-day running this Japanese firm, or Chinese firm does. Did I say Japanese? I think I meant Chinese. But anyway, they have a dual-angle bench plane, and what's interesting about this is these are bevel up planes, and apparently the blade is sharpened at both ends so you can switch it around. So you could have one, like they got one where, hey, I got a standard cutting blade, and then I can switch around to a tooth. The other one you can do a higher angle or a lower angle. So they have both a little block plane and a bench plane.
Yeah, the bench plane, does it, I'm just looking at it, can you actually, is it kind of like a flip-floppable frog so you can have low and high angle? Is that what that is?
I think it's just the ground. I don't think the frog's a standard angle. I think you can just grind the blade at different angles to get higher or lower angle. That's my understanding.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but that's my understanding. But they are Bridge City prices, though. The dual-angle bench plane is $969, and the block plane is $689.
I mean, I love what they do, and I understand that, to some degree, that pricing, because it's precision milling of many materials joined in together, but damn.
Yeah. That's why I don't have any Bridge City tools, and I don't think I will in the future.
Yeah, there was one that almost
got
me.
They look like a little skeleton of a plane.
Yeah, all his stuff. I mean, because he's, I mean, he knows those materials and what he can do with them, and that's the, he always is, I don't know if it's weight savings or what that he's going for, that he's always got little cutouts and grooves, and it's absolutely like a see-through, well, at least the sides. Where you typically have cast walls of a plane, this is a kind of Machian.
Well, we'll have to see if Paul Marcel gets some. And
He's always been a fan. I
live vicariously through his experience.
Yes. But those are very interesting. It's really good to see that it looks like the same design and quality is going in this merger that he went through. That's always good to see.
And hopefully it's successful. I think they make a boatload of money on those little chopstick makers.
You know,
I think they're very popular in the Asian market.
Yeah, I get that. That shocks me to a certain degree, because I get it, and chopsticks are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But how many people before that were making chopsticks, and did it actually improve an existing process?
Yeah.
You know, it probably did, but it's very niche. It's very one purpose. It has a specific thing it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I've questioned. I mean, they're beautiful.
Yeah,
it's very similar. And I'm not trying to be critical, but Andrew Klein's got his pencil maker thing going on now. How many people are making pencils or need to? That this is an improvement on a process, because that's really what I would think as a toolmaker. You're the way you are successful is you're innovating something.
Yeah.
Innovation, though, it doesn't always mean that it's better.
Yeah, I guess it just comes down to sales. I mean, I've heard a bunch of people say, hey, the coolest thing about the chopstick maker is if you have one of those, you have a dinner party and you have people make their chopsticks, and then as part of the dinner party. And it's like, I think that's one of the things that they do with them. You know, I think that's one of the reasons for having one is to have dinner parties and let your guests make their own chopsticks and eat from them. So,
I mean, that's a pretty cool concept, actually. More power to them.
Yeah.
Not everyone's in the market, I guess. That's
exactly.
But somebody has to be.
Yeah. Well, next up, I wanted to make a mention. Today was a big news day. Popular Woodworking magazine was bought out by the parent company of Woodsmith magazine. And Chris Swartz over at Lost Art Press broke this. And apparently the parent company is called Active Interest Media, or at least it's a... Well, it's a division of Active Interest Media called Cruise Bay Publishing that's going to be managing Popular Woodworking. And I'm not sure that they know what they're going to do with it, but they bought it for $1 million, all the rights to the magazine.
Wow.
And they said they didn't buy it to kill it, but they're not really sure if they're going to fold it into Woodsmith magazine, keep it as a separate entity, maybe have it as an online presence only. So we'll just have to wait and see. But just thought I'd throw that out there. We did a few, I guess a bunch of episodes ago, talk about, when they filed for Chapter 11. So
I guess
that's good news that at least someone has acquired them. So.
Mm-hmm. And I would think, and I don't know publishing for anything, but that's a reasonable price.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not uncommon for a craft magazine, or I guess a hobby magazine, to be part of some other publishing company. I mean, that's Wood Magazine has Meredith. You know, they operate well within that. And that was like, that was one of the coolest things about going to the Wood Show, was seeing the Better Homes and Gardens kitchens. Like, that's all one part of one big happy family, and they do a good job of holding it together. So hopefully there's some way that the magazine as a whole can continue being a part of this bigger system.
Yeah.
Or different system. I guess they were part of, F and K, K and F,
K and W,
something like that. Yeah. Before.
Yeah.
No, no. Keep it going. Unfortunately, the people that we know involved in that are dwindling slowly. But wish the best for them.
Yeah. And lastly, I just wanted to make an announcement. Today is also announced that next year's Texas Woodworking Festival is going to be on April 18th of 2020, should I say. So for all of those that heard about the Texas Woodworking Festival and didn't attend last year, well, next year it's going to be on April 18th. So, you know, mark your calendars now and make plans to get to Austin. And I think they're going to have it in a different venue than last year. So it'll be a more indoor venue. So those of y'all that attended this year's, I think they've made provisions. So if it does rain again, it's a little bit more, not quite as crowded.
Good. Did they express an interest at the end of this year's show that they knew they wanted to do that kind of thing? Maybe bigger, maybe more enclosed?
I heard, and Leslie may know more about this than I do, but I heard that, you know, hey, they had great attendance. I think almost 700 or so people came, so it was fantastic. But I did think the rain did damper things, so they were looking to get out of the, you know, being subjected to the elements for this year, for this upcoming years.
Yeah, that was my understanding, is partly to guard against weather issues, but also they did want a bigger venue for more attendance. So, and the venue is bigger than what was available this year. So,
perfect.
Yeah, it should be a good time.
And still in town. I mean, they can still call it. It's in Austin, I hope.
It's still in Austin. I'm pretty sure it's still on the east side.
Yep.
Excellent.
So make plans now to attend. Again, that's on April 18th of 2020 in Austin. So with that, before we get into our main topic, let's talk about what's in the shop. So, Sean, what are you working on?
So most importantly, or so far so most importantly, I took your suggestion last time we recorded about mosquitoes, and I bought some of those mosquito things that you mentioned.
Oh,
and they're hung up in my yard, and now I just got them 2 days ago, so it's too soon to notice, but I hope to hell that they control my mosquito population a little bit, so that's minor. But thank you. My wife was very excited to hear how you mentioned that. It was like, yeah, we have an acre. We need acreage control of those nasty ass bugs.
Well, let me know if that works for you, because I said, my neighbors swear by them, but I've never used them.
Yeah, no, I mean, reading up, it was interesting. It's like it's a mixture of sugar, salt, and yeast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, how effective is it, or could you make it yourself? You never know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it sounds promising, so we'll go with that for now. And otherwise, you know how you say sawdust is man glitter? You've heard that? What is sawdust?
That's sexist, I think.
It might be. Sorry, Leslie.
It's okay.
So I was chopping up a big-ass limb that came down in my backyard today, and I got sawdust crap all over my socks. Is that good, too?
I guess that'll work for, you know, it's not really in the shop, but, you know, it's sawdust related.
Recently, that's as close as I get to woodworking. So there you go. That's my take. I've got sawdust on my socks. How about you, Kyle?
You should say that you were cutting blanks for turning.
There you go. Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Or spoons.
I have actively been drying blanks for turning in my
There you go.
I'm literally in my garage, and I have a it's a 14 inch wide, 18 inch long log that I split in half to make the biggest maple or walnut bowl that I can. And I think it's 3 years drying now. So all in good time. That'll come. I actually probably need a bigger lathe before I try. But hey, sometimes you've got to put the cart before the horse.
There you go. Yeah. Well, I've just been making more parts for the Pete Galbraith rocker. So I've got all my blanks done, got all my turnings done, and I'm just about ready to steam bend some of the parts. I got to steam bend the posts and the spindles and the crest rail. So there's a lot of steam building. I think there's 7 spindles that need to be bent, 2 posts and 1 crest rail. So I got a lot of and like I said, this is all kiln dried stock. So we're going to talk to Leslie a little bit more later about that. But Leslie, what are you working on in the shop?
I am working on a batch of mirrors that the frame is double tapered bent laminations.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of slicing up chunks of wood.
Now, are these your Natasha mirrors?
Nope, they're the Fay mirrors, so the circles.
Oh, okay, the Fay mirrors. Okay, yeah.
Yep. So I'm working on a batch of those with some different woods than I've done in the past, which is fun. And I'm also been working on mocking up some new designs that will be appearing later this year.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's fun, because if anyone hasn't, you know, or if they don't know about you, once you hear this, you're going to go check out Leslie Webb's website, and your portfolio is awesome.
Oh, thank you so much.
I was looking through it today at work, you know, good on company time, but I really enjoy your design. I don't know if aesthetic is the right word, but there's just, you can tell, I mean, I don't know if I walked into a gallery of multiple makers, if I could necessarily pick you out, but I can tell that your stuff is, there's a unified mention to them. Like you can tell like, oh, where you're coming from. Yeah. There's something geometric and open about a lot of it, which is really cool.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Sean. It's like the designs all speak with kind of the same voice. And you can see all of these things from your, you know, your chest, credenzas, coffee tables, chairs, you know, they just all fit in together. It's fabulous.
Thank you.
Yeah. So how did you come up with that design aesthetic?
It was, in the beginning, it was a little bit of an accident, and that in school, and what we got to design our own projects. And in the beginning, I was really focused on learning technical skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I like designing stuff, but I maybe didn't pay as much attention to it. But it sort of started coming out. There were these sort of things that I was interested in that always showed up even without me thinking about it. And then once I saw that, I started to kind of dive a little bit more into the design side of things and try to think a little bit more objectively about that. And it does take a lot of effort and thought into figuring out what you're interested in. And making a decision to kind of pursue those things over others.
Now, you went to 2 woodworking schools, so to speak, the Center for Furniture Design and Sheridan College, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, I can read your website, too.
Yeah.
But out of those two, did they just build upon each other?
They did. When I went to the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, I did not, when I started, I knew nothing.
Right.
And I'm not like being modest. I really knew nothing. And we learned so much in those 9 months. that I don't think I really realized how much I had learned at the end. And I still felt sort of unsure about if I was skilled enough to go out on my own. And of course, my parents really wanted me to finish my undergraduate studies. Mm-hmm. So I did go to Sheridan, and they were complimentary. I mean, Sheridan, we also were designing our own projects, and it was probably a bit more design focused than CFC, mm-hmm. or at least maybe formally. CFC, you can pursue design as much as you want, but it's not necessarily as formally built into the curriculum as it was at Sheridan. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they did complement each other pretty well.
Yeah. And then I heard tell that you did an internship with Michael Fortune.
That's true. I spent 2 years at Sheridan, mm-hmm. and the summer in between them, I spent at his shop trying to squeeze every ounce of knowledge from him and soak it up.
I can imagine. I'm sure you got a lot of good jig making skills.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. Although still, like, my skills are nothing compared to his. I mean, that's to me where his genius is. Like, he's very skilled in terms of hand skills, mm-hmm. and but his jig making is just, and his, of course, his designs are great too, but I don't know. There's something about his jig making that is just, I don't think I've ever met anyone who comes close to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I've read all of his articles that he's done over the years in the various magazines, and seen him speak many times at, you know, like Woodworking in America or Fine Woodworking Live. I think he was there last couple back in April. So, yeah, he is absolutely fabulous. And the one thing I found interesting is he just loves to share his knowledge.
Oh, he is. Yeah. He's so generous. He's a great teacher. And I mean, if you ask him anything, he'll tell you what he mm-hmm. knows. He doesn't. And I think that's generally true in the woodworking world. Mm-hmm. Everyone is pretty friendly. I mean, of course, there's always exceptions, but for the most part, I have found everyone to be pretty generous, but he is especially generous.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, well, I know exactly how that is. I've been working on this Pete Galbert rocker, and I want to build three of these. So every step, it's taken me forever to build the first one, because every step I go, all right, you're building three of these, slow down, take your time, make sure this, you know, this bending form or whatever is right. Just don't, you know, I can sit there and go, I can get by to build one rocker, but if I'm coming back and building two more, I want to make sure I get it right the first time, so the second, third time is easier, and I can easily make any adjustments I need to, which I'm sure I'll run into.
Right. But,
Yeah. In fact, right before this podcast, I was gluing up another form for the post bending form, because I looked at the one I made and I go, you know, that'll work, but if I make this change to it or this change, it would work much better. So let's just make another one.
Right. I know. And it's hard too, because no one, our clients or the people that we build pieces for, never see the jigs and probably wouldn't understand them even if we showed them. But sometimes those are the things that I'm most excited about. It's like, oh, I figured out how to hold this odd shaped thing and cut a miter on it, you know, and you want to show people, but a lot of people would just kind of shrug their shoulders like, I don't know.
Well, so how long have you been a professional woodworker?
So I've had my business for 12 years and I've been, building furniture for about 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. I had to think about that.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's not like, oh, I've been doing this for 10 years. Oh, jeez.
So what's the worst thing and the best thing about being a professional furniture maker?
Oh, my goodness. I think the best thing is being able to take an idea that's in your head and bring it into the world. I think that's just such an exciting process to me, and it's really rewarding. And then, of course, having people want to buy it and respond positively and take a piece into their homes and it becomes, you know, part of their life is really, really rewarding. And the worst thing is probably owning your own business is so many jobs wrapped into one, and you just can't fathom that until you're in it. But it's like having 50 different jobs in one, because you just have to do so many different things, you know, marketing and website and dealing with clients and ordering supplies, and then also designing and producing the furniture, all of that type of stuff, you know?
Yeah. Have you read Chris Bexford's new book?
I have it, but I haven't gotten to it just yet.
Yeah, it's great. About probably, I want to say almost 70% of the book is just about him talking about being a professional furniture maker. And he's saying the exact same things you're saying.
Yeah. I have friends who, they're not entrepreneurs, and they always say to me, like, oh, it'd be so awesome. When you own your own business, you can do whatever you want. And it's like, not really. Sort of like the work never ends. Because even when you're done in the shop, you come in, you need to answer emails or make calls to clients or research something. You know, there's always something else to do.
Right. Now, where is your shop? Is it near your home, or is it offsite, or
no? I have a detached garage, and I didn't use it for parking. So
nobody does.
No.
No woodworkers do.
In Texas, you don't have to. It's not like we need to escape snow, right?
Right.
So I converted it into my shop. And
how big is that? It's not a one car garage.
But it is small. It's 500 square feet. In my opinion, it's right. Like, if it was any smaller, it would be unmanageable probably. Mm. But it's, in some ways, it's nice because it makes me really thoughtful about what machines and tools I purchase. Which is nice because, of course, that keeps costs down.
Oh, for sure.
It would be nice to have, you know, another like 300, 400 square feet. But and maybe one day I'll add on to it. I don't know. But it works well. I mean, I've made, you know, 10-foot, 12-foot dining tables in there. So you can make it work.
Sure.
So, do you find yourself in the shop all hours, or a regimented schedule?
I try to be regimented, but it usually doesn't last very long. I mean, it is sort of weird because, I mean, just this job and in general, because you do have odd downtimes, like, you might have like a huge push to finish a project where you're working crazy hours, but then you might have like a week off before you get the deposit or you have to start the next one or whatever, you know? So it can be a little bit odd, but I do. I used to be a lot worse. I'm better at it now, but I used to go out there all the time. Like I'd eat, I'd have dinner, and then it'd be like, oh, well, I could go glue up this thing, and it's, you know, 20 feet from the house, so I'm just going to walk over there and do that. And then, of course, like before you know it, it's midnight and you're still out there. So I try to be better about that kind of stuff because no matter how much you love it, you just get burnt out doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I do work a lot, probably more than I should, but you know.
Yeah, I think even as a hobbyist, we tend to get burnt out.
Yeah.
Occasionally, and just got to step back for a while and do something else. But so let me ask you this. So the furniture in your house, is it just filled with prototypes?
No, not really. No, it's sort of the tale of, you know, the cobbler's children have no shoes. Mm-hmm. It's
entire sort of house like is that. IKEA. Yeah.
It's just, you know, I try, but often what happens, and I am grateful for this, but often what happens if I make something on spec is I'll have it for a while and I'll totally be like, yes, I'm going to keep this. This is great. If anyone wants one, I'll just, you know, they'll have to order it. And then someone will want it and I'll be busy and I'll think, oh, I could just send them this one and I'll make myself another one down the road. And of course you never do make yourself another one down the road, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's usually what happens. So I get to live with them for a little while sometimes.
Well, that's good. Now you're also kind of, what I've noticed is the de facto furniture photographer for the Austin area. Local furniture makers.
Yeah.
So how did you get into doing that?
Well, that is something that we had to learn at Sheridan. We took a year of photography, and it was specifically photographing our own work. And this was just as digital, like DSLRs were coming on the market. So our first semester, we actually had to shoot everything on film. Mm-hmm. And then the second semester was everything on digital. And man, it is painful when you shoot on film because you don't know if you've got the shots until you've taken everything down and you've moved the piece of furniture out and then you get everything developed and then, oh, we need to do reshoots and then you have to set everything back up. That was pretty brutal.
I bet. That's a whole generation. My kids have no idea what it is.
I know. To
take a careful picture of anything. Right.
Yes. Yeah. And when you're learning, you know, you're going to make tons of mistakes, obviously. So I had to learn that in school. And when I started my own business, I did go ahead and invest in photography equipment, which, you know, it is expensive, but honestly, it's probably some of the best money I've ever spent. Everything that I use now, except for the paper backdrops, which obviously have to be replaced over time, I bought, you know, 12 years ago, and everything's still working. And it's just, you know, it's a skill that not a lot of people have. And so I'm friends with, I'm close friends with some of the woodworkers in Austin, and but you kind of know everyone. And so I'm always pushing people to photograph their work because my feeling is if you don't have a good photograph of it, it sort of doesn't exist in the sense that you can't show it to potential clients. You can't use it on your website. So it doesn't, you can't get more usefulness out of it than just whatever the person paid for it. So I was always bugging like Aaron Fox and Shota Yamaguchi to they needed to photograph their work. Right. They needed to do it. And so we started, gosh, I don't know if it was 2 or 3 years ago, we started sort of doing these group photo shoots, and then slowly other people have, you know, asked, which is fine. I mean, that's yeah. one thing that I'm more than happy to help people with, because I realized mm-hmm. that I was really fortunate to mm-hmm. learn that. And so, yeah, so we kind of started, and it sort of has gotten bigger, but it's still a lot of fun, and it's good. It's good. I think it's good practice for me to photograph other people's work, because when I'm doing my own work, I've looked at it for so long that I sort of already know what angles I want.
Right.
But when you know, sometimes people show up and I've never seen their piece, and it's sort of like, oh, okay. So what are the best angles? What are the details that we need to get, you know?
Yeah. Well, I still remember, I think, a picture you posted a few months ago with your cat staring at your iconic rocker, just kind of like, that was just priceless photo. I was like, you need to put that on like all your business cards or whatnot.
Thank you. That was kind of a lucky shot. That was, that's not my cat. That's actually the shop cat.
Okay.
At the venue where the Austin Woodworking Festival was. Her name's Wendy. Yeah. And she just was hanging out as we were doing shoots. And she just went over and sat. And she wasn't there very long. And I wasn't totally set up when she mm-hmm. got in position. So I was trying to like hurry and get the camera set up and get the lens cover off and get everything done. And I barely got it, because I think I got maybe one shot, and then she stood up and walked off. That's cats for you.
That's it. There you go. Well, one thing I want to talk about to you about is steam bending kiln dried stock. I know you did. I think you and Aaron had some experimentation in that a couple of months ago, and I just want you to talk a little bit about that. And since I'm going to be steam bending some kiln dried stock, I might have a few questions.
Yes,
now, Kyle. I was going to ask you before we get into this specific. How much steam bending have you done before? Other chair projects or anything?
Yeah, I've done crest rails, some hoop backs, but I mean, all of this is green wood, and so it's easier for what I understand. But I have, you know, I guess where I first saw it was Burn Chandler. I think that's how I just know Burn, but he's a chair maker in Australia, and he does a lot of stuff with walnut, and it's all kiln dried because I guess they ship it over there. And he's been bending kiln dried for a long time. And then recently Peter Galbert started doing it. And so I've been paying close attention to what he's been doing. And then I heard about Leslie and Aaron doing some stuff. So I'm interested to see their experience, you know, success, failures, and so tell me a little bit about it and what y'all were actually doing.
Well, so we were inspired by the same people, Vern and Peter, and also Caleb James is another one who's done it. Mm-hmm. And so I have, for a while, I've been interested in doing it, but of course, in school, we were always taught, like, no, you're not. That's such a no-no. You can't do it, you know? And so I just never really kind of put in the effort to experiment until I saw those guys getting really good results. And they're chair makers, so they have to be getting really consistent results. So I sent them some messages on Instagram asking just for, you know, any information they wanted to share. And they were all really generous with their knowledge. And and I thought, oh, well, let's like just give this a go and see if it's going to work or not. And I had a lot of equipment from when I actually started my business in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And when I was up there, it was really easy to find air dried wood. Right. So I had done a bunch of steam bending up there, and I hadn't really done any in quite a while since I moved back to Texas. So Aaron was working on a lamp or a light that he wanted to steam bend some parts for. Mm-hmm. So we thought we would just experiment and see if it went well. And I just, since it was an experiment, I didn't want to invest too much time in making new forms and stuff. So I just used the forms that I used for bent laminating my rocking chair parts. Mm-hmm. And I guess I tried walnut and ash, and I guess it was probably about maybe 1.5 by 1.5.
Right.
And it went really well. I honestly could not tell a difference between it and air dried.
Okay. So you didn't use any overbend forms or anything. You just did the same form you used for your bent laminations.
Yes. Mostly because it was an experiment. I didn't even know if it was going to work. If I was going to do it, I got spring back. So you definitely need to overbend, for sure. But, in terms of it actually bending, it behaved very much the same as my experience with the air dried.
So for the uninitiated, what is the fear of the difference between air and kiln dried in bending?
So the theory, although this does my experience and seeing these
that's the interesting bit. Everyone that gets into it must have a little bit of hesitation and to like you did, and like, I'm gonna try this on some scrap just to see an existing thing. I know how this works with air dried. What does it do with kiln dried? Like, to see the difference for yourself.
So the theory is that there's a substance in wood called lignin, which basically holds the fibers together. And if you dry it to the moisture content of kiln dried, the lignin gets set and the wood won't bend. So the theory is that you need to use air dried, which ideally you want like 15 to 18% moisture content on your air dried. Mm-hmm. And the lignin isn't set. So when you steam it, it loosens it more easily and allows the wood fibers to slide past each other so the wood will bend. That's the theory. But that was not, I don't know. I don't know anything about that kind of stuff, but. Yeah.
Does that change with the thickness? Obviously less material, the thinner you go, less lignin in company,
right?
That kind of thing.
I think it's just that generally the thicker the wood, the longer you have to steam it. Mm-hmm. But, and I guess, thinner wood is more flexible inherently than thicker wood, but both, you can get both to bend.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Depending on your setup.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen like full two inch thick timbers like bent, and you go, holy crap. Obviously. Yeah. The steam has to incorporate all the way in the middle or you're fighting nature. But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. How long were you, were y'all steaming the wood for? You said you were doing 1.5 by 1.5. That's pretty much how the thickness of my post I'm going to be bending too. So
I did.
I mean, I'm asking the question generally, but I really need specifics.
Exactly.
What a coincidence.
Yeah.
I steamed those blanks for 2 hours. I'm pretty sure I steamed them for like 2 hours, maybe 2 hours, 15 minutes. I let them go a little bit longer. The general rule of thumb is 1 hour per inch of thickness. Now, that's what they say for air-dried. I don't know if that starts to change with kiln-dried. Yeah, because
that's what I've heard. It needs to be in there a little longer. Now, did you
did you
soak these? It's my understanding that burn, like, soaks his stuff, like, drowns it for, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's my understanding, too. I did not soak them, mostly because I wasn't organized enough to start preparing that many days in advance.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, because I'm ready to bend now, but I'm thinking about soaking them, which will put me 5 days out, but a little longer than that. But
what species of wood are you doing?
Red oak.
You know, I think it's worth a shot just trying it without soaking. I mean, that was my attitude too. I thought, well, I'll try it without soaking, and then if I need to, I can. But
I might try it without and see what happens.
The act of steaming is not just heating, but it's putting water into it. Right. So
yes.
I mean, I get it.
Yeah,
by soaking it, you're trying to just make this thing completely as loose as you can.
I think it's more about putting heat in there, and the steam is just a conductor of the heat. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. That's my understanding too, is that steam is a better conductor of heat for wood than just heat by itself.
I think with soaking it, you get the water already permeating the middle of that stock. So when the steam gets in there, it's easier for it to heat up. I don't know. I'm pulling that out of my behind.
I mean, it makes sense. Although heat has to get through a thermal barrier to get to that. And heat's not necessarily exciting water vapor. So I don't know that it. I'm a science geek, not really a scientist, but has anyone ever like really taken like thermal cameras to this process and saying this is what's happening on the inside of something that thick?
Not that I've seen.
Somebody's got to, right? I mean, like that would not that it's going to solve any conundrums, but it would be good to know, like, something like that. Like, if you're talking about one guy soaks it for 5 days, he must have a reason for it. But if that's the thing, and that's your thinking, Kyle, or Leslie, you said, I just went with it. I figure, it should be good, right?
Like, yeah.
There's some medium ground there where it would be interesting to know, like, steam, it's not pressurized steam, it's just steam.
Yeah.
Right.
So steam, what does steam do? It gently raises a temperature by convection or whatever, however it's doing that. On a molecular level, I'd be really interested in what happens in the middle of that. The whole thing about case hardening and things that, can really affect something like that when you're messing with part of it, but not all of it, or on the outside a greater degree than the inner, like that can... I'm interested. I'm very
interested. Yeah, and you do have to be careful after you bend the wood, drying it, like bringing it back down to a workable moisture content. Have to keep it clamped to the form, and you have to some people make kilns and put those parts on the form in a kiln. Mm-hmm. I've always just air dried. Just let it dry naturally. But you have to make sure that, air is circulating all around it, or you can start to get checking and splitting and all kinds of stuff.
That's what like metalsmiths deal with.
Right.
If it's an oil quench or a water quench or an air quench, and that does whole things on a molecular level coming from a heating to a cooling, and how quickly that happens and what it does to
the I do have a kiln. So what I've typically done is just, and I've used, green wood, air dried wood. I'm not sure exactly how green, but mainly like firewood and things like that. I got a firewood dealer up the street, and I go, I need the longest piece of firewood you have. I went there one day, and they were actually cutting up the firewood, and I go, okay, here's what I need.
That's great.
And what's great is, you know, I ask them, so, all right, I need, all right, these five pieces will be fine. How much will that be? They'll be $5. I go, here's 10. Keep the change.
Oh, that's great. Oh,
but so anyway, but yeah, what I've typically done is, you know, I'll bend it in the form and let it probably stay around my shop for a couple of days, and I'll stick it in the kiln for at least a good 36, 48 hours.
Are you checking the moisture content?
No.
During that? Because yeah. that would be the tell, right? Yeah. You know, I brought it up to
40%
and that's when bending one thing. And then
yeah.
dropping it.
And I think a lot
of this is on experience, because if Burns soaking his stuff for 5 days, obviously he didn't soak his stuff and didn't have quite
yeah.
the results he wanted. And then he started soaking it and he came up with this 5 day thing.
Get yeah. inside his head and go, okay, why did you decide on that?
Yeah.
Because that's right. excessive. I mean, it's mm-hmm. 5 days. That's a business week of waiting.
Oh.
And so when you're getting into, you know, Leslie, your job, your business of design, if yeah. you had to add 5 days to a project, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that takes a lot of planning and forethought.
Yeah,
for the timing of everything.
Now, I don't think Pete is soaking his stuff, but he is putting it in the shrink wrap bags. Did you do any of that?
I didn't do that either. Again, yeah. I maybe I'm lazy, but I like to start with the least amount of effort and increase as needed. Yeah. And also, I wasn't doing I was just doing an arc of a circle. I wasn't doing right. anything completely insane, like mm-hmm. really tight radius or, you know, compound bend or anything like that. If I was doing something like that, I might look at I'm sort of interested in the shrink wrap just because it seems like it would or the heat. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's shrink wrap, right? Yeah. It would decrease the pressure on you from when the, mm-hmm. you know, the time period of when you take it out of the steam box to
right.
how long you have to get it bent. So that's yeah. sort of nice, because it can be sort of a frantic kind of right. go yes. situation. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's any yeah. time I've seen it, it's always rarely yeah, one person, but you
yes.
bring it out and you put it in there and, yeah. and somebody else is clamping it behind you as you go kind yeah. of thing. Cause it's
usually
like,
you have about a minute to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now fun. I will say that Michael Fortune gave me some great advice about steam bending, which was that if it starts to go wrong, you can stop, put it back in the box.
Right.
Get like reorganized, take a breath and try again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I had never really thought about that,
because
it always feels like you've got one shot.
Well, I do have 1,500 feet of shrink wrap in my shop downstairs.
Oh, see, I did look into the shrink wrap, but did you get yours from Uline?
Yeah. There was another place that I could get it for cheaper, but I wasn't sure it was of the same quality. And I go, well, this is what Pete's using. Let me use this. And if I ever run out of it, I'll try the cheaper stuff.
Right. That's what I did look into it.
Yeah.
And then I thought, I don't want to buy this much shrink right. wrap, because if I don't need it or like, I'm just going to, what else am I going to do with this? You know?
I don't know what I got years ago, yeah. but I get that catalog every once in a while. I love Uline yeah. stuff. I'm like, yeah, when do I need massive quantities of, you know, in, you know, commercial, you know, things like that. But I mean, if it works, it works. Like,
yeah. So I think I might try bending these posts without soaking them in the shrink wrap and see what that happens. Like you said, if it doesn't come out right, I can always then soak them and try to re-steam them.
Right.
Yeah.
Now,
the only thing about the whole re-steaming thing is, if you're doing, in your case, Kyle, like a chair back, and your steam box is very linear, you know, because you put it's meant for sticks of lumber, and then you bend right. your curve, like that may.
Well,
this is a fairly gentle curve. Yeah,
this is straight. And you might be able. Yeah, you might be able to strain it back out and throw it back in the steam box. But are you going to use a backup strap or a compression strap?
I thought about that, but I haven't bought one. So, and like I said, this is a fairly gentle curve, so I'm not sure it's really needed. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, I know Lee Valley sells those nice little jig things, and then I've heard you can get away without them. But I think you're the one that said, "Hey, this is worth its weight in gold."
Yeah. I mean, maybe you'll be okay.
Yeah.
And I should say that I never really tried it without it. So
yeah. Now we'll say this. Except for the posts I'm bending, all my other forms are two-part forms. So it's got a.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the most important thing though about the strap is that it puts it under compression.
Yeah.
Because wood bends better under compression than tension. Mm-hmm. So when you have those two stops, you know, on either end, it puts the whole blank under compression, which allows the fibers to kind of slide past each other instead of break out.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly have never had a piece fail on me when I've been bending it.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely attribute that to using that Lee Valley strap because I don't think I'm particularly skilled any more so than anyone else, but that strap to me is so good because, one end is a fixed stop and the other end is adjustable. So when you put it in the strap, you kind of snug up the adjustable stop. And then as you're bending it around, you can kind of watch what the piece is doing and either, you know, tighten it a little bit or back off if you need to. Like if you start to see a little bit, if it's really hard to bend the piece or if you start to see like really tiny compression failures, which look like wrinkles, you can just sneak off a little bit on the compression or if it's like blowing out on the backside, you can put more pressure on it. But that, and what I have found is every piece of wood is different.
Right.
For how much compression it wants. So
sure.
I've seen people that make their own straps and they have both stops are fixed. Yeah. And I don't understand how they calculate that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because the actual length of the piece changes as you bend it.
The inside face
shortens, and the outside one is longer than the inside one. So I don't know how they figure that out. Do you?
I don't know either. Yeah, but
I've always wondered that. Like, how
I've seen them do it too. I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of people using those compression straps, especially like who is it? Jeff Lefkowitz, if I'm pronouncing his last name right, with the Boggs chairs, and he's always putting them bending those. And I want to say, I don't know if his are fixed or not, but I'm gonna have to go back and look at that.
Yeah,
they were, but I could be wrong.
I think they are, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But so I'm not really sure how they calculate that. Now I know David Duyard also teaches that Boggs class, and he's so maybe I should ask him.
If you find out, let me know.
I will.
That's one of my biggest things is you know, when you're bending, if you like, your form has to be really good to keep square faces square. If you're going in with 4S material, how does that change when you're doing that? You know, everything we know about stretching material makes it thinner. So if there are critical dimensions somewhere along that bend, if it's chair back that you need to put, you know, uprights in or whatever, you know, there's something going on there that you've got to compensate for. And then if it deforms in some way, now you're stuck cleaning up a curved surface, which is far more complicated than a square flat surface.
Yeah, unfortunately, you always got to clean up this curved
surface. Well, no, yeah. you do. But if is it a case where if you had, and I don't know the style, but a round chair back that bends around but has a bit of a hand rest on it that's kind of formed, can you do that beforehand and then bend it, or do you always shape that after the bend?
You always shape it after the bend. You're talking about like a continuous armchair?
Yeah, continuous armchair with something like ornate or done up in the end of it. Do you ever prepare that before the bend?
No. That's afterwards.
Yeah, okay, like and then so like then
carving then, the
yeah, like the little. I mean, it's not a total flaw, but like as I'm sitting in a rocker that has a partial, you know, arm like that, and that would be. Then you have the pain of carving in symmetry on two sides. Like that. I mean, that's why you're craftsman, I guess. But damn, it'd be great if you could simplify that.
Or you could figure out a jig to hold it so that you could do something on a machine.
Yeah, just do it really precise. Right. Yeah, exactly.
No, you have to clean it up anyway, because once you steam it, it's all... It's like you have to sand it. Like it's a mess. Yeah,
it's a noodle. Nasty. Oh, hell. If you soak a piece of stock for 5 days, you might as well have done nothing to it first, because its grain is going every which way it wants to when it's soaked with water. I mean, that's
right.
Yeah.
So most of the, like everything I have bent is always bent oversized. And then once it's bent, I take it down, I join it, I plane it. And sometimes I'll use like a pattern routing jig and route it to the final shape that way. So there's some milling to do afterwards. Now the benefit of seam bending is that you get that continuous grain that follows the curve. So it's a lot stronger than like if you just cut it out of a solid piece.
Right. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Now, you also do a lot of bent lamination, correct?
I do. Yes.
Yeah. Do you ever do that tapered bent lamination?
Yep. What I'm working, those mirrors that I'm doing now are actually a double taper, so they go from thin to thick to thin.
Yeah, I'm looking at that. Oh, yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, so that's a fun little thing to do.
So are you using vacuum form to do that?
No, you can't. You can do bent laminations in a vacuum bag. I tend to just clamp them onto forms with calls. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what we did in school. So that's just what I do. either way works, depending on, the circle would be hard to do. A circle would be hard to do in a vacuum bag, but,
I remember at a Fun Woodworking Live, I saw David Marks doing a demonstration on doing bent laminations, and he was doing these over this form, and he was using bicycle inner tubes.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Stretch and wrap.
Yep.
Wrap. That was pretty fantastic. But
yeah, that works too. I mean, it's just a different way to clamp it, right?
Yeah.
With consistent pressure. I mean, like, because it's a rubber membrane that's just being stretched over all of the outer surface.
Yeah.
Yep. I guess I tend to clamp things onto forms, because in a small shop, it's easier. It takes up, it's less space than having my vacuum bag set up for days at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's probably part of why I tend to clamp things onto the forms too.
But I did see that huge vacuum bag table they got at the school, or I don't know if it's at the school or in the one of the shared workspaces there where the school's located. But
I don't know if I've seen that.
I thought I saw when I was there at the Texas Woodworking Festival. A huge vacuum bag thing.
It might be some. It might be someone's.
Yeah.
It might be. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was in one of those spaces that it's rented out or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some.
They're very. They're useful, those vacuum bags.
Yeah. Well, before we move on, I just wanted to let you have an opportunity to talk a little bit about what's in the pipeline. I think you mentioned earlier you're about to come out with a new line or some new designs.
Well, new designs. I have a solo show coming up next March in Austin. So I'm working on some.
It sounds new like a road
stuff.
Trip.
Yeah. So it's going to be at a gallery. In Austin, and we don't have exact dates yet, but it is going to start in March. So I've been working on some new stuff for that. So yeah, I have a lot of ideas right now, and I'm not sure what is actually going to get made.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just sort of in the design process and working on some like models and mock-ups to see which ones I want to make and which ones we'll keep till later.
Okay. Well, good. Well, let's, before we close out, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices.
Or should we say drink choices?
Our drink choices. So, Leslie, what are you drinking tonight, or what would you like to recommend?
Lately, I have been liking the Allstadt Kölsch, which is Allstadt is a brewery near Fredericksburg,
mm-hmm.
out in the Hill Country there, and. I've been enjoying their Kölsch lately. It's a nice sort of clean, crisp beer for a hot Texas summer.
Well, great. Well, that reminds me of one question I forgot to ask you. So you said your first business was in, did you say Philadelphia?
Yep.
So what brought you to Texas?
Well, I'm from Texas. I grew up here. So I just returned.
Well, I could tell by the accent, but I noticed you spent a lot of time up in the Northeast.
I have spent a lot of time up there. I spent most of my 20s and early 30s up there, mm-hmm. and then I moved back here several years ago. So, yeah.
All right, just curious. So Sean, what are you drinking?
So I also like good refreshing, beer in the summertime. It's just starting to get warm up here. Other than you Texans, I'm way up north. But I picked up the Terrapin Beer Company. They're out of Athens, Georgia. They're good to goza, which is a good goza. Basically, gozas are brewed with salt water, and then this one has grapefruit appeal added to it, which gives it a nice little citrus kick. It's quite good.
All right. Well, tonight I'm taking a little break and actually drinking wine. I'm not a wine connoisseur by any means, so prepare for me to butcher these next names coming up. So it's Italian wine. It's a Val Pacella, I believe is the way you pronounce that. Sure.
Policella.
And it's from Villa Mafia.
Maffei. M-A-F-F-E-I.
Yeah. But anyway, it's a nice low cost red wine, and it's I've had it before, and it's kind of our go to house wine around here, and it's really good and inexpensive, so highly recommend it.
I will say that this Terrapin I picked up it was $6 for a six pack. Nice.
Hey, that's not bad. That's not bad.
That's really good.
That's really
good. Now, this isn't like $3 Chuck, but it is, I don't know. I think it's like $10 a bottle, somewhere around there, $10-$12. So it's not bad.
Yeah, not bad at all.
Yeah. So before we let you go, Leslie, where can people find you on the interwebs?
My website is lesliewebdesign.com. And they can find me on Instagram at lesliewebdesign.
That's right. And boy, you all, I don't know how much you're on Instagram, but you always seem to like everything before I get around to it.
It's a bot, right? Some bot. Minion doing that for
it's,
you.
It's an assistant. No.
Oh. Anyway, yeah, I followed somebody new today that I heard on another podcast, and as soon as her first post popped up, oh, Leslie Webb liked that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. Well, Sean, where can folks find you?
I'm at SeanW78 on most everything, including Instagram, the, as you will say, only social media that matters. So, yeah, check me out there.
All right, and you can... follow me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters. And with that, that just about wraps it up for this show. So if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes or Google Play Music, or just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. Then you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes. And while you're there, please leave us a review.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Woodworkers Association. If you like the show, be sure to visit modernwoodworkersassociation.com. You can follow the MWA on Twitter at MWA_national, on Instagram at MWA_podcast, or like the MWA on Facebook. The best thing you can do is tell a friend. Word of mouth is what keeps us going and sharing our discussion.